Hi, everybody. How are you? Hope this finds you well. Thank you so much for joining us for another week of Soundtracking, my weekly podcast where I dive into the minds of creatives to talk about their relationship with film and music, both personally, but also professionally. And Christmas continues to come early on Soundtracking, as once again, we have two guests for you instead of one. First up, a bit of a legend in my mind, given that he scripted both American Beauty and 6 Feet Under. Alan Ball has now written and directed a little gem of a film in the shape of Uncle Frank, which you can watch on Amazon Prime. Starring Paul Bettany, Uncle Frank tells the story of a gay man forced to confront his past on a road trip with his niece and has all the wit and nuance of Alan's previous stellar work. Then, perhaps even more impressively on a certain level, I'm joined by Viggo Mortensen, who not only wrote and directed, but also starred in and composed the score for Falling, his first film behind the camera. A long time in the making, Falling sees Lance Henriksen play the homophobic Willis, who's forced to move in with his gay son when he starts to exhibit signs of dementia. Falling is out in cinemas as of today, the 4th of December, and it's also available to watch at home. For more details on where you can see it, just head to modernfilms.com/falling. Now, we'll get to both of those in a moment. Before that, a word from our very good friends at Grass & Co, who have been incredibly supportive of the podcast. And if you're a regular listener, you'll have heard me praise the benefits of this brand. Grass & Co, if you didn't know, are a premium CBD range of the finest quality, ethically sourced CBD blended with therapeutic botanic ingredients. And there are three ranges: Calm, Rest and Ease. And I genuinely find that it helps me with, well, a number of issues really, including anxiety, stress and sleeping. And that's down to the way they've been created to relax your mind and soothe your body. Also the way they've blended all natural botanical ingredients, including ginger, turmeric and orange or ashwagandha, chamomile and mint. So the taste is smooth and delicious. Now, as well as the CBD oils, Grass & Co. have a wonderful collection of other companion products that help with your daily routine. It's best to start low and slow. The 500 milligram Calm range of CBD oil is a good place to begin your journey. Taking it first thing in the morning really sets you up for your day. It brings a touch of tranquility to whatever lays ahead for you. Also part of the Calm range, you have a wonderful balm that can release muscle tension and aching joints, whilst also deeply nourishing dry, sore skin, perfect for this time of year. And it can also be applied any time of the day to pressure points or temples. Then you can end the day with Calm body oil after a relaxing bath, a candle or pillow spray to help you unwind and get the mind and body in the mood for a good sleep. I do swear by this product and the benefits I feel are quite extraordinary. Grass & Co. CBD oils contain no trace of THC. All the CBD products are totally legal to buy, consume and supply in the UK. Interested? Then find your Calm with 25% off plus free shipping at grassandco.com/sound. That's grassandco.com/sound. All you need to do is use the discount code SOUND at checkout to claim your 25% off the Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Also, with Christmas around the corner, and if you're searching for a gift for someone special, the Grass & Co. Christmas shop is now open, including an incredible selection of gift boxes from the Little Box of Christmas Calm and Silent Night Kit to the Ultimate Luxe CBD edition. Find memorable presents that will last long past Boxing Day. A Calm Christmas all wrapped up in one. I know we all need that. Visit grassandco.com/sound and use the discount code SOUND at checkout to claim your 25% off the entire Grass & Co. ranges. And so to Alan, whose wonderful film Uncle Frank is scored by Nathan Barr. And it's with one of Nathan's cues that we begin. Came out to Beth. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course.
Congratulations on the film. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
What a beautiful film.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
How long has this particular story of Uncle Frank been in your head?
You know, 30 years ago, I was living in New York City, and I went home to my home state of Georgia, my hometown of Marietta, Georgia, to come out of the closet to my mother. And when I did, she said, well, I blame your father for this because I think he was that way too. And I don't know if that's even true because he was already dead. And so I never had a chance to talk to him about it.
Yeah.
But the next day we were driving around North Georgia visiting relatives and we passed a lake. And my mom said, that's where Sam Lasseter drowned. And I said, who's Sam Lasseter? And she said, he was a real, real, real good friend of your daddy's.
Oh, wow.
And I later found out that my father had accompanied Sam's body on a train back to their hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. I don't know. This just opened a window in my head of what if, what might have been, what might that story have been?
Yeah.
So it's complete conjecture on my part. But it sort of percolated in my brain for about 25 years. And then 4 or 5 years ago, I sat down to write a script and Uncle Frank is what came out.
Wow, that makes it even more powerful here in the kind of, you know, the personal stories that it's that are in there that form this beautiful story. I think Paul Bettany's performance in this is extraordinary.
It really is.
The subtleties and the depth of emotion that he shows in this is just so great to watch. I mean, I've always loved him as an actor. And he kind of, I don't know, it's funny with Paul, and I love getting the chance to talk to him as well, but he just reminds us every now and again, he's sort of almost like a firework, throws these extraordinary performances at us every now and again, just to remind us how great he is. Not that everything he isn't and he's great at, but in particular, there are certain films, I think, that really allow him to, I don't know, to dive deep, to kind of really get to the soul of a character.
Right. I agree. Absolutely. Well, you know, the story had personal meaning for him as well.
Yeah.
He's told the story many times, so I can repeat it, I think. His father came out of the closet at 63 years old and spent 20 years, had a 20-year relationship with a man. And then when that man died, As Paul's father got closer to death, he went back into the closet because he was a very staunch Catholic.
Yeah.
And he was afraid of not getting into heaven because being gay is a mortal sin. So for Paul as well, I think it was a chance to sort of play a what if scenario. What if his father had been able to fully embrace who he was and accept who he was? And he had a lot of personal meaning for him as well.
I'm glad you persuaded him into that role. Thank you.
It didn't take a lot. I mean, we had one conversation and he was we had one fun phone conversation and it became clear to both of us that it was kind of the perfect fit.
The music in the film is wonderful, both a wonderful collection of needle drops, existing pieces of music, be that the Isley Brothers or the Capitals and Apollo 100 and Joy in there as well. But Nathan Barr's score is just perfectly pitched and beautifully placed in between those moments. And really, I don't know, for me, I just felt like almost like the introduction to Frank is almost the introduction to the score in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It really plays an important part. That first score cue when Beth comes out on the porch and she sees Uncle Frank and we start her narration is just so beautiful. I love Nate, and I worked with him on True Blood. But he what he did with this, and with the, you know, we had very limited resources all around. I think I remember this correctly. I think I remember having to fight to get him live musicians.
Wow.
We just didn't have any money, but I'm so glad that I was able to convince the folks at Miramax to pony up for that, because one of the great joys of my life was being in Nate's studio for the recording session and just hearing the music performed live.
Yeah. Did you know what you wanted from the score? Did you know that, what were the conversations that you had with him about what you wanted that score to sound like, but also to achieve?
I mean, we had conversations, and I remember saying I wanted it to feel like memory. I wanted it to feel pastoral, but I didn't want it ever to do... I didn't want the score to, you know how it's a fine line you have to walk for a score, perfectly augmenting what's happening emotionally and stepping over the line and pushing it too much. And so I said, we have to always be really careful to not fall over into it becoming overly sentimental. You know, he's remembering, when he remembers those moments with Sam before everything went bad, it's just this time of innocence and discovery, and there's a purity to it. So we talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
I did mention that one of my favorite film scores of all time is Elmer Bernstein's score for To Kill a Mockingbird, even though I felt like it probably was too big for what this movie called for. Gigi, what are you doing? Stop it.
I just got a puppy, so I'm in this world. Just, we have a 14-week-old puppy downstairs, so I'm it's a new world for me. So yeah, I just saw your dog behind there paddling behind. But anyway, you were saying, sorry about Elmer's score.
It's just but Elmer's score for To Kill a Mockingbird has that thing of that sort of rich emotion from such an innocent time in one's life. For that movie, it was Scout and Jim and just being children. And for our movie, it was Frank and Sam before the powers of fear and guilt and shame were destroyed them.
I think the score as well does a wonderful job between those two time frames as well. You know, the kind of the now and the memories. And it, in particular, there was a couple I jotted down where the cue were at the funeral. which almost has double meaning to Frank in a way. But the cue that's used there is so beautiful in bridging these two, you know, worlds together almost. And yeah, and really cutting through beautifully.
Yeah. Nate's really good. He's a really good composer.
Is it?
And he wanted to do this. So he was, I mean, everybody did this for scale. You know, nobody made any money making this movie because we all just loved it so much. And also because, you know, nobody would give us any money to make it. So we had to make it with a shoestring budget and a schedule.
Well, you can't tell, Alan. You can't tell. You hide it well.
It looks so much more expensive than it was. That's the production designer, Darcy Scanlon, and cinematographer, Khalid Motaseb, really, really did amazing work with very little resources.
I love that section of the film as well. That's the road trip.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like a short film within the film itself. It's a wonderful section of the film as well. I thought it was just... Yeah, I love that. And just how you get to, you know, with Peter has just got this brilliant presence and his timing and even his kind of placement within a, you know, within a the sort of structure of a frame. Just he's just precision, I think, as an actor is extraordinary. He reads everything, I think, so well. And I love that character. I loved Wally. Oh, my God, yeah. I loved Wally so much.
Me too.
He must have been a treat to write, like a lovely character to write.
He really was. I always thought that Frank would probably end up with someone who was very different from who he was.
Yeah.
And from a very different background than the one that Frank came from.
Mm-hmm.
Just because Frank was running away from himself and running away from that world. And I also thought... It's so interesting. People from non-Western cultures sometimes have different attitudes about things that almost seem to us like cognitive dissonance. Like, I think it's really interesting how Wally can't possibly come out of the closet to his family, but he doesn't, for whatever reason, that doesn't manifest as shame
yep.
in himself.
Mm-hmm.
It just manifests as, well, I can't do that, but I can still have a relationship with them. You know, I can still call my mom in the middle of the night. And yeah, I have to lie and tell her that I'm married. And you know, someday she'll meet her, but that's not that important. Whereas for a Western person, it's like, oh, the shame. I'm consumed with shame because they haven't accepted me. And part of what Frank's journey is he has to learn how to accept them as well. And their limitations. And one of the things I really enjoy about the film is at the very end, after Aunt Butch says, you know, you're all going to burn in hell, Frank goes, I know that's the best that you're capable of.
It's such a good line. It's such a great line.
Yeah. Yeah.
With those, the needle drops and the fact, you know, the Isley Brothers, It's Your Thing and Cool Jerk in there, are those... When you're deciding on the choices of tunes, obviously there's the period the film is kind of set, so there's a connection with that, so it's got that authenticity to the period and the time stuff. But are those personal choices? Are those, how do you come to make those decisions about those specific tracks? I know money's probably an instance as well, but yeah.
I do... I put source cues in the script, and then when the editor gets a hold of it and starts working, he made suggestions and found some other things that seemed to work. And anytime somebody goes like, well, what about this? And if it seems to work better than what I had originally thought, I'm like, yeah, let's go with that. Of course, absolutely. But then once we had cut, we had songs that we were really happy with and that we felt really worked, we found out how much they would cost.
It's insane, isn't it?
It's insane. You know, we had Sly and the Family Stone in there. We had, I can't remember now exactly what it was, but we had some, and they worked fantastically, but they just were too expensive and we could not. One of the songs that I did like that I really fought for to keep, and I got a little extra money for that too, was the Martha Tilton song, Does Everyone Know About This? That Frank is playing the morning after the party.
Does everyone know about this? Does everyone know about this? This wonderful thing that's making us cling. Is it something new that just the two of us found? Or has it been around before we met? This is the dish they call love. Hey, waiter, please pardon my glove. It's like caviar, a chocolate bar, something which will help us hitch our dream to a star. Did all the people near and far get hep to it yet? Do fishes in the stream get on the beam the way we're doing? Caterpillars glow when lights are low and they're cuckooing. Does everyone know about this? Or have they been slow about this? Discovering your kiss was better than Chris Columbus when he landed in each history book. Look, everyone should absolutely know about this. Fishes in the stream getting on the beach like the turtle dove who fell in love. Everyone should know about this.
It's so great. And all the options we tried and all the options we looked for, they just didn't work. We had Nat King Cole in there at the dinner with Beth's parents and in Frank's apartment, and Frank's phony girlfriend couldn't afford that, you know. So ultimately I'm very happy with what we got.
Yeah.
But I do look forward to a day when I make a movie where I actually get to I can afford the first choices.
A blank check for the music.
Oh my god, I see shows on TV, and like I was watching The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, which is fantastic, but I was just like, oh my god, what was their budget for needle drops? Because it's we could have made an entire movie with the budget they have just for that.
Yeah,
it's insane.
But then you look at American Beauty and the score and the needle drops in that as well. And that's we had the pleasure of spending some time with Sam Mendes talking, and we talked at length about your incredible script for that. And Sam was just talking about how much was in there for him as a director. You know, it was kind of just extraordinary. But for you, is this something I haven't asked anyone? And I was really interested to hear, when you see your script taken into, you know, film and a composer doing their work on it and the beautiful score that Thomas Newman did for American Beauty, what does that feel like when you see your work, you know, the kind of almost the finished product with this kind of interpretation, I guess, of it on screen?
Well, that was amazing. I mean, that was an amazing experience. And I was pretty spoiled by that whole experience, being my first experience in getting something I'd written produced. Everybody kept saying to me during that entire process, because the script sold and then it went into production pretty quickly. And everybody kept saying, you know, it's not always like this. I mean, I had songs that I had written into the script that Sam, rightly so, just kind of ignored and you know, took his found music of his own that worked and worked so much better than the things I had chosen. think one of the things I have learned over the years is whatever vision exists in my head when I'm writing the script,
yeah,
exists for me to get the words on the page. And then once I do that, I need to take my vision and let it go. Because it's such a collaborative process, and so many people are going to have different ideas, and just because of probability, mm-hmm. a lot of those ideas are going to be better than what I originally thought of.
Yeah.
And so ultimately it becomes for me about what is best for the movie and what is, you know, and just trying to see, well, I didn't see it that way, but this really works, mm-hmm. and be able to go with that. And that's true now, even that I'm directing myself. You working with the cinematographer, I had very clear ideas of how I wanted to shoot things. And he would say, yeah, but what about this? And I would just go, oh, yeah, that's much better. And also, we have to shoot 8 pages a day. So that'll help us out there.
But there is that kind of this wonderful, you're right in terms of what historically has said, I just think is extraordinary. And I think of how brilliant and almost kind of ahead of the game you are with the writing that you've done for TV as well. And I remember kind of when 6 Feet Under kind of hit the screens, and it was such a kind of brave and brilliant and creative series. And I absolutely loved it. And I just thought I had never seen anything like that before, or characters written like that before on TV. And it was so nice to kind of just pop back into it, knowing that I was coming to chat to you and remember how I felt when I first watched that series. And I think that paved the way for so much TV that we see now in terms of I guess the kind of vision and the scope that you can have with a serialized drama, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. Do you appreciate mm-hmm. that it was, I think, a real benchmark in TV?
Well, it was part of it came around right at the same time, you know, just after The Sopranos, which was a huge, for me, inspiration and eye-opener because I'd been working in TV for years. I've been doing sitcoms. They were fine, you know, but we weren't doing anything that was new or different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw The Sopranos, I thought, wow. I never really knew that TV could be something like this, that it could be so cinematic, that it could be so layered, that it could be so smart. It could be so morally ambiguous and just the freedom of not having to, you know, be the delivery system for advertisements, which is, you know, what most TV was at that time, was just really super inspiring to me. And I had never done a drama. I had done plays, I had done theater, I had done 4-camera sitcoms, but I'd never done anything like 6 Feet Under. So for me, it was a kind of like a huge discovery process as we went. And I just sort of trusted my instincts. And I also had a really great writer's room. And of course, that amazing cast and other producers on the show. But for me, it was like film school. Because I learned so much that I didn't know going in. And I'm very proud that it's part of that turning point in television, where television began to discover what the medium was capable of.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, that continues to this day. And it's super exciting to watch.
Yeah, I think it absolutely was. It was everything about it. You know, it was the aesthetic of it. It was the performances, but the characters, that was the thing for me that really stood out, was like, I'd never seen these people represented on TV in such a beautiful and accessible way, I think is probably the way that I would probably put it. If people are looking for something to watch in lockdown and they haven't seen any 6 Feet Under, 63 episodes or something, isn't there? It's like, go on, get started. We don't know how long this is going to last for, so. Have you found it's been interesting chatting to people as well about how they've reacted to, you know, this situation that we find ourselves in, the crazy world of COVID and politics and whatnot. But have you found that it creatively inspiring in a way? Has it allowed you the time to explore things and to write and to, yeah, how have you found this time?
Yeah, I wrote a slasher movie.
Great.
Just for my own entertainment. And also, obviously, I think I had a lot of anger I needed to get out. So I got it out by killing a bunch of frat boys. Nobody wants
to make it. They are the root of all evil. So it's kind of,
you know, people have read it and nobody wants to make it, but I'm working on a TV pilot for something, and then I've been putting together a pitch, a Zoom pitch for a limited series that we're going to take out probably after the first of the year, because I don't think anybody's buying anything right now, because I don't think anybody has any money, because when COVID hit, I think everybody just poured all their money into development. But I'm also bored. I'm bored out of my mind. Yeah. I really enjoy being in production. I really, really enjoy being in a writer's room. I'm fine, but yeah. I'm going a little crazy. I've had some not so great days.
Yeah.
As I'm sure everyone has, because it's just, it's so weird.
Yeah. It's just got to take each day as it comes and just almost embrace however that day, you know, presents itself to you, really, isn't it? It's kind of, oh, it's going to be one of those. Tomorrow's going to be another one. Let's move on, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
When I went back to watch Uncle Frank for a second time, I kind of had this wonderful, I don't know, it's got so many layers to it as well, I think, that I encourage people to watch it more than once as well, because you kind of see things on a second view and that you don't necessarily kind of, because you're in this luxury and in this beautiful, beautiful film. But it could be on the stage. It could be a theatre production, this, I think, as well. It's got such a kind of beautiful simplicity to it as well, in a way that it's got this kind of, I don't know, I kind of envisioned seeing Paul Bettany on stage.
Well, I started in theatre, and pretty much all of the cast are accomplished theatre actors. Mm. I do. One of the things I like about writing for the screen as opposed to writing for the stage is the ability to, you can have a scene that's half a page. You know what I mean? And you hit that story point and you move on. Whereas when you said you can see it on stage, I was thinking, well, how would you do the road trip? And how would you do this? And how would you do that? But I do think one of the things that makes it feel like it could be on stage is the language, the musicality of the language, because of the Southern dialect and that whole sort of thing. So that the language becomes more important than it perhaps it is, you know, usually.
Yeah, I love the relationship between Frank and Beth. It's just, it's really, really, really special.
How amazing is she?
Oh my God, Sophia, she's incredible.
The first time I saw her was on HBO's limited series, Sharp Objects.
Yeah.
She played young Amy Adams. She didn't have a lot to do. I mean, just when there were flashbacks, there would be like, you would see her, you know, roller skating. And and I remember seeing it and I went, who is that girl? Who is that? Because I couldn't take my eyes off her. And we were casting at the time, and I went on IMDb and saw that she was 16 years old, which is exactly between Beth is 14 at the beginning of the movie and 18 for the rest of the movie. I saw that she had done Stephen King's It, which is not a movie that I saw, not the kind of movie I would go see on my own. And so I rented it and watched it, and she can carry a movie. She can carry an entire movie. And I said, let's offer it to this girl and hopefully she'll say yes. And she did. So that was extremely fortunate for us, I think, because so much of the movie is Beth just observing.
Yeah.
You know, and Beth just seeing and listening. But there's something so luminous about her face and those eyes, especially, that you just, she just pulls you in and you really feel like I'm seeing the movie through her eyes. And we were very lucky to have her.
I'm looking forward to enjoying her career and where she goes and what she does, for sure. It's been such a treat to get to chat to you. Really, really, really is. Thank you for your time and congratulations again on the film.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite interviews I've done. So thank you.
Oh, very kind of you, sir. Thank you so much. Please take care. Stay safe. And I look forward to watching that slasher movie.
Hopefully. Take care. Stay safe. Enjoy your new puppy.
Oh, I will. Thank you
what
so much.
What kind of dog?
He is a Portuguese water dog. We nearly called him Barack, but we didn't. In the end, we called him River. And he's brilliant. He's fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Keeping our mind off everything else, which is lovely.
So helpful. Yeah. All right.
Take care. Thank you. Featured on the soundtrack to Uncle Frank, that's It's Your Thing by the Isley Brothers, rounding off this first part of another soundtrack in doubleheader with Alan Ball. You can watch Uncle Frank right now on Amazon Prime, and I suggest you won't be disappointed if you do. It is a beautiful film. Next up is a bit of a first for the podcast, as we bring you someone who has, well, pretty much single-handedly made a movie, having written, directed, acted in, and scored Falling. You can see this in cinemas now, and you can also watch it at home. For all the details, head to modernfilms.com/falling. And since Viggo Mortensen wrote the music for the film, well, we'll start with one of his cues, Come and Gone. Hi, Viggo, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thank you so much. It was lovely to watch your film again after we did that wonderful Q&A with everybody maybe about a month ago now, I think that was.
Yeah, time goes.
Yeah, totally. Thank you so much for doing this. It's quite a unique thing to speak to someone about their film where they have written it, directed it, starred in it, and also composed it. I think this might be a first for us. So well done. And the results are so beautiful. When did you decide that you were going to do all those jobs, first of all? Was that always the idea?
Well, I mean, I was on my own with the project for quite a long time. So while I was trying to raise the money and find somebody to join me in a producing capacity, I had a lot of time on my hands. We found the money, lost the money. I tried to work on another project for which I would not have done the music, writing, directing, and I would not have acted in it either. But then I didn't get enough money together for that either, and went back to Falling and got that done. But in all that time, you know, I kept working. Lance Henriksen was with me from the beginning, you know, from the first go around. And I kept working with him. And so was Marcel Ziskin, the cinematographer. So we kept working, sharing images, sharing ideas, you know, in terms of trying to come up with at first, just generally a tone for the movie overall, and then for differentiating in terms of image, you know, the flashback scenes, the recent past, the distant past, and what the present should look like, and, you know, just all those things. But apart from the two of them, in terms of working on the script and working on the visual approach, well, also Carol Spear, the production designer, But they were there. They were assuming they would be available. They were going to stay with us, you know, stay with the project. But otherwise, I was on my own in the sense that I kept, you know, working on the script, kept fine-tuning it, kept playing with the structure of the scenes just to make sure that everything followed as best I could. You don't know until you start shooting some things, but I was just trying to organize myself. So since I was on my own, I also started thinking about things like the music. Also thinking about what means were we likely to have, not much probably in terms of, you know, but mainly for creative reasons, I just started thinking about it. How much do I want for this story? I always felt that it should be discreet.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I generally don't like it if a composer tries too hard to make me, to tell me what I should think or feel. Any more than I do a director, you know, or a cinematographer or an actor. I like to see things for myself and think for myself as a spectator. And that's the kind of movie I wanted to make, one that I would like to see. And in terms of the music, I started thinking of themes, not just overall what the type of music it should be. Early on, I thought, well, it should be, I mean, I started composing some themes on the piano and I thought, no, you know, it should probably be a piano-based score, I think. Mm. That would be a good way to do it. Melodies, sound effects from the piano. And then because I'd worked with him a lot over the years, Buckethead, guitar player, the two of us basically made the score. But there were certain things that we had done before that I thought something in that vein would work, you know. Occasionally the guitar could come in, it could be by itself, and sometimes just together with the piano. And but most of the way it would be piano. And so, you know, I mean, there was so much time before we actually shot that by the time we shot, I knew most of the places already where I was going to use music.
Wow.
And I had a lot of it composed, basically. So, and then that kept going. As we were editing, I thought of some more things, a little bit less here, a little bit more here, something a little bit bolder here, you know, depending as things were coming together. Because I found I had not had experience editing image before, really, but I had had quite a bit of experience editing music, producing and editing, mixing, you know, music that I'd done with Buckethead. And so I found that in editing image that it was a similar, it wasn't that different, really. It was about timing, rhythm, and
motion.
You know, each image, it was like, okay, boom, boom. Okay, that's as long as it should be there. And then you put that scene next to another scene, and then you start to realize, no, it should go one more beat. Boom. And it was very much like editing music, I found, editing the image. So it all kind of went together. By the time we were done with the edit, we had the music basically sorted, and we went in to record it in London and did it in like 2 days. I mean, basically, it was very fast. But that was just because there had been so much time to prepare. In the same sense that although we only had 5 weeks to shoot the movie, which is not very much, when you look at all the children with their limited hours, the winter hour, day, you know, shooting in winter with limited daylight hours and different time periods, it was kind of an ambitious schedule. But we prepared really well beforehand so that we were able to do things in a more efficient, calm way. And it was the same with the score. We had it really and just put it down relatively quickly because we'd worked on it a lot. And so it came out the way it did, and I was happy with it, and I'm still happy with it. I've seen the movie several times as I've presented it to people. And it would have been, it was tempting to do more, but it just felt right. And it's, I think it's one of those scores where there's actually more there than you realize, but it's not intrusive, you know. It sort of accompanies without underlining too much or trying to push you toward paying attention to any particular thing. It just felt right, you know. But that's like, I think it's a function of working on it for a long time and listening to it over and over and you know, settling on what feels right for this particular story.
I think that you can tell the connection that you have through all those different roles within this film, though, because the kind of synergy between everything is so beautiful. And it's really interesting you say knowing when to not have music. And that can sometimes be the hardest thing, is to not put music in a scene, to hold back from it. And in particular, I love that the crossword scene at the end, which is so such a beautiful moment in the film. And a lot of people would have had that music kind of coming in towards the end of that scene before it cuts, but you don't, and you hold back, and it makes, when the music comes in, kind of even more powerful. I think it's such a, it's just so beautifully crafted. Yeah, it's like, it's almost like it's the kind of the heartbeat, or the kind of, the fluidity of it that sometimes you don't always hear. And like you say, you don't realize how much is actually in there.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that section up, because there's an example of something else that I was very attentive to, you know, being that it's a medium that gives you tools, gives you options. You know, when I'm working with the sense of differing memories that the son and father have, what the memories of a person that's in the initial stages of dementia is, you know, you're playing, sometimes showing that through image, sometimes through image and sound, sometimes through sound alone. And sound, you know, the sound, it's always this way, I suppose, in a way, if you think about it. But the sound mix, in other words, which sounds you accentuate, which, where you place them. And this is especially evident if you're watching it in a cinema, obviously, much more than at home, I suppose. But the timing of the sound, you know, even in that scene, there's, you know, the leak from the overspilled bathtub has largely stopped. But there's a drop here and there still into that pail, into that bucket. And you know, we timed those things. We timed when you hear the wind. The wind is, there's something about the place in the past, in the present, always. That place where Willis lives, there's always wind. And you start to notice it in that scene, and then you start to imagine, okay, this man alone in that windy place, you know.
Yeah.
That sort of those things come together, but it's really subconscious. I don't like it for someone to, I mean, someone like you might notice those things, but it all hangs together. It's part of the score, really, the way the wind works, the way those drops in the bucket work. And so for me, that was, in a way, it doesn't count officially as score, but
I felt
with the sound mix, we were scoring that scene in a way. It's almost like the instruments that are, the feelings that you're going to get musically once the music comes in at the very end of that scene with those images from outside that place that they both share, actually, where there's a connection, where there's been disparate memories and sometimes conflicting memories of, say, the mother, wife figure, things like that. now there's a coming together of memory of that place, that farm, that landscape that's shared by the two of them. But leading up to that are the sounds of the real place of that room, the creaking of the chair, the wind, the drips in the bucket, you know, all these things.
Yeah.
The scribbling of the pencil, you know, trying to find the crossword, just a little sound.
Even the way he moves the broken crockery with his slippers across the floor,
right.
Even that
those
kind
things,
of, yeah.
Or even being there, he's starting to get emotional about trying to cover it, Willis is, and just the sounds he makes. All of that to me is like a prelude to then the music comes in. It should make instinctive, like physical sense when that music comes in. So it was very interesting with image and sound and score. I didn't really see them as separate things. They had to work together.
I also love as well the moments where you have these lovely, almost kind of, they're almost like breaths, I feel, where you've beautifully shot, just captured something to do with nature. So be it frosty leaves or the sun kind of cascading through something. And they only maybe last for about 15, 20 seconds. Throughout the film, they're kind of peppered and you have these beautiful little cues along them as well. Mm-hmm. And they're almost kind of like, I find them almost like breaths, like almost encouraging me as someone who was totally just enraptured with the film and memories and, you know, conjuring up my own memories and my relationships with my family as well. But they just almost reminded you to breathe.
Well, you have to be careful how much of that you put in. Same with the music, but with image, you know, when you start to show that kind of nature imagery, and even though it's part and parcel of what this family is, you see it from the very beginning, all the sort of the duck hunting and the everything that follows with the story about this duck outdoors and then indoors and then the next morning and then in the kitchen and then, you know, all of that. You have to layer it in judiciously, I think, and you don't know until you're really farther along in the editing how much is too much or just enough.
Yeah.
And with those nature images, even though it's very much part, like the whole duck thing introduces the relationship the family has with nature, and it shows the dynamic of the family through that connection with nature and the duck and life and death and all those things. But then as we shot a lot of footage and recorded sound also, but in nature to use, but then you have to just lay it in very carefully because otherwise it can be really, like any aspect of a movie, can be self-indulgent and it can be like, okay, another shot of the forest or another, you know what I mean? It has to just feel right and move the story along and contribute to, well, hopefully what happens is what happened to you. And I've heard this from audiences in different places at Q&As where they say, I don't know why, but it made me think of my uncle, or I don't know why, but it reminded me when I was a little kid, this happened. And then they often would tell me a story that has absolutely nothing to do with the story of falling, but on an emotional level, it did for them. And it was in part from images that they'd seen because they couldn't explain it, and in part from the score and the sound mix. Sometimes they would point out something, an event, well, when that happened, or when the old man is on his own on the beach and it was a secret between us and him that he was fine and he was having a good time and he had escaped and all that, and although the family worried and so forth. And obviously that's one of the more, okay, now we're really going for it in terms of score, because it added to this release or this relief, escape, you know, for him. So it was interesting how people relate that. And then they would say, well, it reminds me of my grandfather because of this and that. And it was something that had nothing to do with that scene, for example. But I really enjoy that when there's a connection made, you know, because ideally, by not trying to push and telling, underlining everything and showing and everything and trying to indicate to the audience what they should think and what they should pay attention to. You allow them to make the movie their own. And the best thing that can happen, I think, is that you've told a story, and by the end of it, they have their own opinions. It's become their movie. It's become their movie story. And they might bring up things that you'd never thought of, and they may be right. You say, well, I never thought. Well, you seem like you were doing this. I said, yeah, maybe, without even thinking about it, or maybe not. Maybe it's your story.
Nah. Well, it's almost like when I always think it's the same for, you know, musicians when you release an album. It's like you've obviously put all, you know, this hard work and emotion and creativity into it, and be that personal stories or whatever it is. But once you release it, it's not yours anymore. It belongs to the person that's either listening to it or watching it, and it's up to them.
And they'll have their own associations from their own life.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the duck. Did I read that the duck story actually happened to you?
Yeah, that's one of the only sort of events in the movie that are taken from real life. But I thought that was really useful because, as I said, it introduces the dynamic, the family aspect.
Yeah.
It introduces the landscape. It introduces their connection to nature. As I say, life, death, all that. Yeah. And it just seemed right. And but yeah, I did. I was 4. It was a different landscape. It wasn't North America. Actually, when I was four, I was in Argentina, but it was winter and it was out in an area like that. It wasn't as wooded. It was, you know, but it was a pond, a small lake, marshy area. And it was cold and it was getting dark. And my dad just, I don't know why, on a whim, I was sitting on his lap already, I think. And he said, "You want to try?" And I did. And I got a lucky shot off. And then all that, the bathtub and sleeping with a duck, with my father sort of taking my side, that did happen. And my mother was thinking it was just absurd. He's a dead animal. Why is he in, you know? Well, I'm taking it away as soon as he goes to sleep. I mean, I imagine that conversation, because I did wake up and it was gone. The only real difference, apart from the landscape being different, was that I was probably angrier than the boy in the movie was when the duck was gone. You know?
Yeah.
And I stayed annoyed longer than he does. You know? I had to really say, look, that's it. I'm not talking about it anymore. If you want to take part in the preparation of the duck, you can. But that's what's happening with it. And then I did pluck it in part. And I did watch the cooking. And then it became interesting again. You know?
It's amazing. I love it. Such a great story. Lance is extraordinary in this film. I mean, the complexities of a character who's going through, you know, what he's going through is just, and just the way he plays it. And I love as well when he gets home, you know, when he gets back to his surroundings, his, you know, his safe place, how you see that and you feel that in the character in terms of, I'm actually okay here.
Yes.
You know, you're dragging me around here, there and everywhere, trying to get, and I'm fine here, you know, and it's John who lets the bath overflow, and it's, you know, it's all that stuff. It's such a beautiful, beautiful performance.
I mean, it wouldn't matter how hard we worked on the image and sound mix and the score if we didn't have that performance from him. I mean, not that it wouldn't matter, it just wouldn't, it wouldn't be complete. It wouldn't work as well, you know, because his performance is riveting, and it's brave, it's kind of fearless. He doesn't care about how he's judged as an actor, he's just doing it. And the way he listens to people, I mean, he has a lot of dialogue, a lot more than he usually has as an actor, and he does it really well. A lot of emotionally demanding scenes and complex scenes, but it's the way he listens to people, the way he reacts to people and goes subtly in and out of different mental states. It's a marvel to watch what he does, you know?
Yeah. When you talked about earlier about the kind of how the line between getting all those pieces kind of right, you know, in terms of making sure you're not forcing someone to feel a certain way about things and all that kind of thing. When you consider that this is the first, am I right in thinking it is the first feature film you've directed?
Yeah, first anything. I haven't directed a short or anything, yeah.
It's so kind of just pitch perfect on all those levels in terms of, you know, how it looks and how it makes you feel and how it sounds and the performances like we just talked about as well. And I wanted to ask whether you've been like a human sponge over the years with all the amazing directors that you've worked with in terms of, you know, just watching and observing and taking things in with the idea in your head that you knew you wanted to direct at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate. I've been, especially the last 15 years or so, maybe the last 20 years, but I've worked with some really intelligent directors, really well-prepared men, women from different countries with different, you know, obviously cultural backgrounds and different approaches to filmmaking. But, you know, this just their insistence, their sort of quiet insistence on a degree of excellence beyond what you usually experience on a movie set, just from everyone, just by their example, you know, by the way they prepared to shoot, you know. You know, I realized from these people that whether it's David Cronenberg or Jane Campion or Matt Ross or Pete Farrelly or even back to, you know, Peter Jackson in a way, although that was a much bigger, sprawling enterprise, but that you can never prepare too much or too early for a shoot. You never put too much thought or watch a movie enough times or be in the editing room enough or think about it over and over, because something will just suddenly click after the 300th time that you've seen a scene. You're like, oh, wait. Oh, okay. Why didn't I think of that before? You know, but you have to give it time, really work at it. And the more you can do of that before you start, you know, and the more you do it collectively with the crew and with the actors, when you start filming, it just feels like a continuation of a process rather than, oh, we got to start. Who's doing what? What are we doing? You know, none of that. Everybody knows what you're doing. And that's why, even though I had some misgivings about acting in it, they quickly dissipated right on the first day. I realized, yeah, no, we have a plan. We all know what we're going to do in terms of sound, in terms of image, camera placement, lighting, what the places look like, what shots we have today to accomplish. It wasn't that distracting because I trusted the team and we were in sync. And so I was able to fully focus on Lance and act with him, you know, on an equal playing field, trying to solve the problems of the scene as fellow actors. And so, it was, yeah, I learned a lot over the years. And yes, I have been nosy, actually. And I'm just curious about nosy over the years. Some people don't like to talk about it, but you know, you just watch them. But there's plenty of cinematographers that I've spoken with, and gaffers and costume designers and then just watching, I said, oh, that's interesting that they're choosing these shots to cover this sequence, maybe only these shots, and from that angle, that's interesting. And and then another step is just watching the finished movies, the way they're edited, the choices, you know, why on that line are you on that character? That's an interesting choice. And it either seems right to me or maybe I'm not sure, you know. And so each of those steps, each of those viewings tells you something, whether you realize what it is or not, and it accumulates so that, you know, by the time we were shooting Falling, even though we'd also talked about other movies and photographs and all kinds of things, and I thought about lots of even scores and everything.
Oh, did you? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I just sort of thought what things work, but I kept coming back to, well, this is a particular story. I have to suit this. I can't really... Mm-hmm. And we never talked about other movies or other scores or anything else. But we just, I think we assumed the way I do as an actor, that you do all this research and then you put it to one side and then let's see what happens. I really know this character as well as I can at this point. And whatever happens on the day, whatever another actor throws at me or the director expects or asks for, I can adapt to that new approach or that new demand in character. As an actor, and just like as a filmmaker, as a director, I was also adapting to how the actors were on the day, what the weather was like, and so forth. But we already, it was what the scene asked for, what we had planned to do.
Yeah.
And we could make little adjustments because, in a calm way, because we already had a good, very thought out plan. And all of that helped. And we never had to refer to, well, we're doing a scene like so and so did in that movie, or this is an homage to that movie or that line in that scene or something. And some directors do that and they talk about it openly. And it's just a different approach. It's neither better nor worse. But that wasn't what we did. I mean, we just sort of, we shot the movie the way the movie asked to be shot. And I scored the movie the way I felt it asked to be scored. and based on communication with people and involving people as much as possible. You know, the first day I said, we have a short amount of time to shoot a lot of material and we have one chance to do this. So let's, you know, anybody that has an idea, a suggestion, no matter how silly they might think it is, please speak up in time. Don't bring it up to me, an idea you had about a scene we shot the day before. Do it in the moment. It's never going to be an annoyance. You never know. A good idea can come from anyone at any time. So no matter how much we prepared, what we're going to do. So that's how it was made. And I think by having that kind of communication with the cast and crew, everything went more smoothly. And it was a great experience. I liked it. It was every bit as difficult as I thought it would be, but it was even more satisfying than I dreamed it could be, you know, might be.
How was directing Cronenberg?
It was easy. Very professional.
Takes direction well, then. Good.
As I said to him when I sent him the script, I said, you know, this isn't like a favor or a gimmick. I've seen your work as an actor before, and you'd be perfect for this part, in my opinion. But if you don't want to do it, don't worry about it. You know, we'll do it with someone else. Fortunately, he wanted to. And it was a nice moment. When he came on the set, obviously he's a very respected and rightly so filmmaker. But in Canada, you know, he's sort of a deity, really, and for a crew, for a film crew. And so he walked on set and it was like, oh, the man is here, you know, kind of thing.
Shirts and ties on.
Practically. But everybody was on their best behavior and watching him. And I'm like, come on, let's go. No, but he sort of made a couple of silly jokes. I don't know what. He was just sort of irreverent and relaxed. And so everybody calmed down and got to work. I only learned recently, like in the last month or so, in one of our Q&As or one of our interviews from Lance, we were talking about that scene, and the director and the interviewer was saying, wow, I'm David Cronenberg, that must have been something. And he said, yeah. And I described this thing with the crew, how they reacted, and then calmed down and we got to work. And then Lance says, yeah, it's Cronenberg, this guy Cronenberg. I mean, I had no idea who it was. I go, really? I didn't know that. I thought you were just on your best behavior. He goes, no, it was just this skinny older guy who was just like this kind of really into being this doctor. And he was, you know, he had seemed to have kind of a wry sense of humor. I thought, wow, he's quite formidable as an actor. Where did they find this guy? And then, you know, this guy Cronenberg, they kept talking about. And then he left. And then, you know, he said, I felt like an idiot, because then I realized a couple of months ago, I saw an interview on the internet where you and he were, I think it was a presentation in Toronto of Crash, did a surprise course, and I brought him on as a surprise on stage, and we were talking. It was sort of a dialogue, you know, post-film. And he said, and there you were with the proctologist. Are you kidding me? It wasn't until you saw that you thought, oh, this is a director. Of course I've seen Eastern Promises and I've seen all, you know, The Dead Zone and all these movies. And it's like, oh, okay. He had no idea when we were filming, which was...
That's amazing.
Yeah. He just was in character and just sort of annoyed by him, and it was perfect. So, yeah. I've asked people at Q&As in different places recently, you know, I've sort of asked for a show of hands. How many of you knew that it was the director, David Cronenberg, playing the proctologist in the scene in the clinic there? And it'd be like 10%, maybe 15 at most, sometimes less. And then I'd say, well, who thought that the scene worked and that he was a good actor, that character who played that, the person who played that character was a good actor? And they are pretty much unanimous. I said, okay, well, that was the main reason for casting him. I wanted the scene to work and I wanted the actor to be good. For the rest of you, I suppose there's an added allure or something, you know, maybe amusing or something, or maybe disturbing, depending on what your visual associations are with his work. To think of Batman putting on a glove and
what he's going to do with it.
Inserting his long finger into your body. It's like, oh, no, not that man. But it was great. I'm so glad he did it. And he's great in it. It's a nice scene.
Yeah. Listen, we've run out of time, Viggo. It's so great to talk to you at length about this wonderful film, and massive congratulations. I really hope that it's kind of I don't know, got your kind of the excitement for whatever is next in terms of what you create. And it's been lovely as well, because we've had quite a few people on the podcast who we've talked about, you know, Matt Ross was on, we talked about Captain Fantastic and that wonderful score and George Mackay and that brilliant Guns N' Roses cover at the end. And oh, it's amazing. And Warren Ellis was on talking about the Rhodes score as well. So we've had you as part of it, but it's lovely to come on and talk about your film. And massive congratulations again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
From the score to Falling, that's Resolution by Viggo Mortensen, rounding off the second part of Soundtracking with the, well, wait for it, writer, director, actor and composer. My huge thanks to both Viggo and Alan for taking the time to talk to us. Uncle Frank is available to watch now via Amazon Prime. And as I said, Falling is in cinemas now, but you can also watch it at home. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including both of my conversations with Sam Mendes. And please do subscribe while you're there, though your preferred podcast provider works just as well. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please, if you have the time, be sure to try and look us up on YouTube, where you'll find a regular companion show that I put together to accompany the podcast. Next up on the show, talking about many things, including creating that fantastic score for the TV series Sherlock. Michael Price is next week's guest. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, stay safe.